This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Tech billionaire Elon Musk is known for creating bold new companies such as PayPal, Tesla, and SpaceX, for championing liberating technologies like Bitcoin, and for hyping visionary plans to colonize Mars. But with a net worth of around $200 billion, he's not just the planet's richest person. He's also one of its biggest welfare recipients, report Lisa Conyers and Phil Harvey, authors of Welfare for the Rich, How Your Tax Dollars End Up in Millionaires' Pockets and What You Can Do About It. By 2015, they write, companies led by Musk had gotten billions of dollars in subsidies, tax breaks, and other handouts. New York State, which is perpetually broke, even shelled out $750 million to build a solar panel factory for Musk's Solar City operation, and then said the company would pay no property taxes for a decade, saving another $260 million. Musk is not alone, say Conyers, a veteran journalist, and Harvey, a really successful businessman who donates to many libertarian organizations, including Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast. There are literally thousands of other immensely rich people out there who are constantly bilking governments at all levels for special perks, carve-outs, and handouts paid for by middle-class and poor people. In exhaustively documented and perpetually enraging prose, Conyers and Harvey show how millionaire farmers, billionaire team owners, and filthy, stinking rich oil and gas and wind power barons lobby Congress, rewrite zoning laws, and plunder the public fisc. They also outline realistic and effective ways to fight back and level a playing field that benefits the people who need the least help from government. Here is the Reason interview with Lisa Conyers and Phil Harvey. So, Phil Harvey, Lisa Conyers, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Phil, you're going to your penthouse in the sky. What is the elevator pitch for Welfare for the Rich?
Well, given my propensity for lengthy answers, I hope the penthouse is on a very high floor. But basically, this book is about what we feel is the outrageous unfairness of the many government policies. I mean, government is supposed to be in the business of solving problems and ameliorating difficulties. But here, in terms of government policies that take money from taxpayers and turn it over through a variety of programs and subsidies and loan guarantees and a dozen other methods, actually make the rich richer, continue to pour money into subsidized programs for corporations particularly, but also for wealthy individuals. We are outraged and distressed by these facts, and the book reflects those views and attitudes while it describes the various programs.
Yeah, I love, this is on the first page of the book in the introduction, and this is an unapologetically libertarian critique of the welfare state for the rich. But you write, most Americans recognize the importance of a safety net for America's poorest. Welfare programs for those in serious need, though often flawed, are means-tested and generally reach deserving parties. And this is also something you guys have talked about in previous work. But you say there is simply no justification providing cash benefits and subsidies to America's rich. What's most remarkable about these policies is their variety and ubiquity. And you talk about how governments at every level are shoveling, just barrels full, wheelbarrow full of cash. Let's start with some of the big ticket items here. We talk about agricultural subsidies, and that costs something like $96 billion a year. In going to big farms Generally, that where the people who run them or own them are very wealthy. And we're talking people who are millionaires, if not billionaires, when they run large corporations. Lisa, can you talk a bit about, you know, what is the ag subsidy that comes to mind that, you know, just really should outrage people the most?
Well, I think the most shocking thing that we learned when we started looking at these ag subsidies is how they almost entirely go to people who are not poor, who are wealthy and don't need the money. And they go to crops that aren't necessarily crops that we should even be eating, you know, so that we're not subsidizing the best food that we could be growing for Americans and then giving it to Americans. We're actually mostly subsidizing corn and wheat and sorghum and sugar and things like that, that are not necessarily what we should even be growing. But there's just so many examples of people who own farm property but aren't farmers by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, we have, you know, senators and congressmen that are getting farm subsidies because they happen to own a farm.
Can we name names? Who is the wealthiest senator, you know, when you were writing the book, who's actually pulling money off of the tax?
Well, I think back? Phil, what's your favorite one? Penny?
Well, the senator per se keeps changing. It keeps changing, Nick. But there are a number of individuals and farms. I mean, my favorite example is a billionaire named Penny Pritzker of the Pritzker family in Illinois. She's not just a millionaire, she's a billionaire. You know, that's a fairly substantial pocket of wealth. And she's not a farmer. You don't have to be a farmer to get farm subsidy payments. All you have to do is own a certain amount of property that is classified as farmland.
How does that work? I mean, you know, because one of the things that in reading this book, which is immensely documented, the footnotes are at least 50% as long as the text itself. It's immaculately and comprehensively documented. But how, you know, one of the things that is, I think, difficult for people to get is like, how does somebody like Penny Pritzker, who, what was she, an ambassador during the Obama years as well?
She has been an officer in the government at some time, but I don't think that's the reason she gets farm subsidy.
No, certainly not. Yeah, but I mean, but it's something, somebody like that. How does she, what is the program, how does she end up getting farm subsidies?
She owns agricultural property. It doesn't even have to be a working farm. One of my other favorites is a chap in South Dakota whose son owned a pheasant farm. Well, a pheasant farm does grow grain. Because pheasants like grain. And if you want to have a farm where you can get people to come and pay to shoot pheasants, you grow some crops. And it can't possibly have been the intention of the people who designed the farm bill back in post-Depression years to be subsidizing pheasant farms. But that's the kind of thing that we're doing. And Penny Pritzker just happens to own some agricultural property. That's all that it takes.
And I think the important thing to say is that, you know, when these farm subsidies came out, everybody's envisioned these farmers, right? These guys who put on their overalls every day, went out on their tractors and went to work. And that sort of remains in the people's subconscious and when they think of the farm bill and helping farmers. But what they're really doing is they're helping very large farms, you know, corporate farms. And that's not how farming is done in America anymore. And it's, you know, there are very few family farms left and they're not the ones getting the majority of the subsidies. So you can just own the property without ever getting your hands dirty or planting a plant, you know, and still get the tax break. And it's not just tax breaks. There's, you know, there's insurance programs where they insure your crops. So whether you grow the amount of crop you thought you were going to that year or not, you get paid. There are programs where if you put your land out of production, you get paid to keep it out of production and not growing crops. So there's an incentive to put perfectly good farmland, you know, aside. So there's just a variety of programs out there that really have very little to do with helping, you know, Mr. Farmer on his tractor, you know, grow food for America.
It doesn't, you put it all together, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. It's crazy. A lot of these subsidies for rich people have no, when you look at them in toto, have no reasonable rationale for existing at all. But you get a little patchwork, a subsidy here, a special payment there, and this kind of thing goes on over several decades, and all of a sudden you got an incredible conglomeration of bad rules, regulations, and laws. The one thing they have in common is that the well-off never suffer.
Yeah, and you know, with the agricultural subsidies in particular, you point out, you know, there's people like Penny Pritzker, who is a Democrat, you know, in terms of her political affiliations, but then Philip Anschutz, the guy who bankrolled the Weekly Standard and bankrolls the Washington Examiner, is a well-known conservative. He's pulling farm subsidies, as is the family of the conservative Republican governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem. So this is not, I mean, this is part of the book, right? Is that it's not about, you know, conservative versus liberal or Republican versus Democrat. This is really about kind of the rich versus the rest of us.
No. And so for this book, I traveled around the country for 4 years, interviewing people on all these different topics, and politics seldom came up. I mean, the only thing that came up was, how come all these rich people are getting this money that we can't get, you know? So it was very much not a political thing at all. It was just, it was, you know, if there were two sides, it was the rich and everybody else. And politics had very little to do with it. In fact, most of the time I had no idea whether I was talking to Republicans or Democrats or libertarians, or I didn't know their political.
I suspect you knew if you were talking to libertarians, but one way or the other. Just to stay on farm subsidies a little bit more, you mentioned corn production. Mm-hmm. A huge amount of the reason we grow corn, I mean, there's stuff like high fructose corn syrup, but it's also ethanol. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into farm subsidies, kind of the idea that we should be growing corn in order to make fuel out of it?
Well, I think that all started with just trying to make, you know, we're trying to move cars into being cleaner and more energy efficient and all that. And we've just agreed that we're going to put, I mean, the vast majority of our corn is not eaten by humans. I think it's less than 4% actually ends up on your plate as corn. And a lot of it is also exported. So it's not just going to ethanol, but it's also going out of the country, which is the case for actually a lot of our crops. We're not growing them for Americans. We're growing them for export. So, but the ethanol, you know, boondoggle that it's been, I mean, it's very profitable for farmers to switch, you know, to sell their corn into the ethanol supply. And it's frustrating for, I mean, I met a lot of farmers who, unless you have really good newer engines, ethanol is really bad for your engine. So I met a lot of farmers that would say, hey, we're growing this corn, we're being forced to put ethanol in our engines, and they're not good for our farm equipment. So it's kind of a crazy situation that they find themselves in.
Well, and the ethanol program is nuts, almost from top to bottom. We grow a lot of corn for ethanol. It's more expensive to get fuel that way. As Lisa says, it's not necessarily good for your engine. And it's causing environmental damage as well, because an enormous amount of acreage now is devoted to raising corn for ethanol, and we're plowing under prairies and other ecologically useful parts of the earth. And the fact that it's a boondoggle, as Lisa says, is well illustrated by Charles Koch, who says and has said quite openly, the ethanol program is a bad program, but we make money at it, and as long as those are the rules, we'll go on making money at it. The man is honest.
You know, I guess it's considered an agricultural subsidy, but Phil, in particular, could you talk a little bit about sugar? Because this, yeah, I guess it's a subset of this, but, you know, what is the policy, what is the federal policy towards sugar, and how does that amount to welfare for the rich?
Well, talk about a patchwork of idiotic laws and regulations. It's almost impossible to untangle them all when it comes to sugar. There are import quotas. A certain amount of sugar may be imported from Mexico, a little bit from Haiti or the Dominican Republic, then it's limited very, very severely. The price is fixed by the government. All of this to make sugar cost roughly double to anyone in the United States. All consumers are paying more for sugar or product that contain sugar because of these tariffs and quotas and interferences. And a handful of cane growers, most of them are cane, although some of them grow sugar beets, are benefiting because the price is artificially propped up. And a chap named Pepe Fanhulin in Florida has become kind of the poster boy. He's a billionaire, too. There are a lot of billionaires in the book and the programs that we describe, raking in the money because the price of sugar is so high because of all these regulations, tariffs, duties, and quotas.
And they know that essentially, I mean, they know they're not going to have foreign competition because it's blocked through tariffs and quotas. And then they get the price is subsidized. When did that start for sugar? And why does it persist? Because there are, you know, as you kind of document in the book, there's a handful of businesses that really dominate the domestic sugar production industry. Shouldn't it be easy to get, you know, a majority in Congress to be like, hey, get the hell out of here. You know, we're going to actually free, you know, free the markets and sugar.
Well, it should be easy. Yes. And in fact, a very competent and persistent congressman from Illinois, do you remember his name, Lisa, whose constituents included a number of candy factories.
Oh, yeah.
Has been working in Congress. I mean, he's a congressman for many, many years to get this changed because his constituents are losing business. Mm-hmm. The businesses that are using sugar in his Illinois constituency are closing down. A lot of the business is going to Canada. It's insane and unsupportable. But as Milton Friedman once remarked, there is nothing more permanent in Washington than a temporary government program. And the sugar program is a temporary government program that has existed for decades and decades. It's
When did it start?
That I don't remember. But,
I don't remember either. I want to say in the 50s. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Fanhold brothers give millions and millions of dollars to both sides of the aisle. You know, they lobby very, very heavily. and so that, you know, I mean, that's how a lot of this stuff happens, right? I mean, you just, you know, make friends on the Hill and you just make sure that your subsidy is renewed every year or every 4 years or whatever the case may be. And
yeah, one of the things that comes across in the book, I mean, you guys have various charts at various points pointing out the return on lobbying. There's one chart in the book that's something like, at one point, there was something like $4 billion in lobbying in a year, and there was a $4 trillion in kind of subsidies that came out of that. So that's, it's a pretty good return on investment, right? That, yeah. Let's talk about tariffs because, you know, this comes up with something like, this was a big topic under Donald Trump. Donald Trump, as you guys point out, when he was president, talked about himself. He said, I'm a tariff man. He, you know, he's like hearkening back to the 19th century or something like that to William McKinley, I think, was a big tariff man. We'll talk later about, you know, how things will be different or not under Joe Biden. But it's, you know, tariffs are taxes that are put on foreign goods. And the idea there is that it punishes foreign producers or something. It doesn't quite work out that way. And one of the things that you do, which I think is incredibly useful, is you have a chart that looks at the kind of basic names of certain types of products subject to tariffs and then what that costs. And so, for instance, tobacco has a U.S. tariff rate, a general rate of 350%, peanuts, 163%, canvas shoes, 48%, waterproof footwear, 37.5%. It goes down the line, tuna. Bras are come in at a tariff of 23.5%. What What is the general theory behind tariffs, and how do you make real to people the amount, the overall amount that they're paying extra because of tariffs?
Well, the theory behind it, and it is only a theory, exemplified to a considerable extent by Trump, but part of our tariff policies long before Trump, is that by putting tariffs on imported goods, you are providing a stronger market for U.S. manufacturers of those goods. Occasionally, that even occurs, but the result is that everybody pays more for whatever is being taxed at the border, and the beneficiaries, a very small number of people, maybe one or two companies, and they benefit. Historically, they tend to benefit only temporarily. But like a lot of these programs that we describe, the patchwork is, it turns out, over a period of time to be almost insane. You've mentioned a few, but some of the most highly taxed imported goods are things like inexpensive footwear and a lot of food products that low-income people depend on quite heavily, whereas the cross-country skis and badminton rackets have no tariff at all. It's almost as though a bunch of congressmen had sat down at some point and said, "How can we screw the poor?" Now, I don't think that ever happened. But the pattern of tariffs now looks as though it did. In the same category, glassware, a slightly more expensive version of a dining room water glass is taxed at a lower rate than the cheap ones that low-income people might be more inclined to buy. So it's upside down. Any improvement in all this under Joe Biden, I'm not terribly optimistic, because one of the first things he's done is create a Buy America rule for the federal government, which immediately means paying more for anything the federal government buys. It interferes with supply chains for the production of almost anything. And in the same breath, he said he's going to support the Jones Act, which is an egregious example of how to make life more expensive for everyone in order to benefit a handful of shipping companies that overcharge and whose fleets are rusting.
Yeah, Lisa, could you kind of explain what the Jones Act is and the way that that functions to... Again, transfer, you know, it may not, well, I guess it transfers money from relatively poor people and then gives it to mostly fabulously wealthy people. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Jones Act is basically protects shipping within the United States. So anything that is shipped from one state to another has to be on an American flagged ship. And it's actually not just the 50 states, but also Puerto Rico, Guam, places like that. So we heard about the Jones Act, for example, during that last big hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, when it took so long to get food there because we had to ship it on American flagged ships. We couldn't just go with the lowest bidder and get some supplies over there. We had to go with American flagged ships. And so it protects it's very protection. I mean, it protects the maritime industry in America, and it allows for no competition. So you can't just go in and bid and say, "Hey, I'll take your goods from Louisiana to you know, New Hampshire for cheaper." We're not allowed to do that. And it's been around for a very long time. And it all along, it's been designed to just protect maritime workers and shipbuilders in America. And the result is we have this aging shipping fleet that is still in business, and our tax dollars are paying to keep those ships running. because we can't do anything else.
Because if they were actually subject to competition, they would be updating and they would be coming up with ways to economize on, you know, on making their service cheaper to attract more business.
Right. And, you know, there's certain states that suffer from this a lot more. Hawaii gets hit very hard. Everything that goes to Hawaii has to be on American flagships. And so everything is, I mean, when people complain about how expensive it is to live there, that's one of the things. And that's the hard thing about tariff is it's so diffuse. It's not, you know, when you go and shop for shoes, there's not a little tag that tells you how much of that shoe price is for the tariff. But actually, maybe if there was, we could get people excited about getting rid of these things, right?
Yeah. Having said that, you know, there are calorie counts on every, right, almost every food product now, and it hasn't stopped me. I don't know about you guys, but I think it would be an interesting start to break down the cost of goods as they're put on the shelf due to, you know, various kinds of policies.
Right.
Is there a generally agreed upon figure that either tariffs generally or the Jones Act specifically adds to the costs of goods and services in the United States?
I don't have that number.
Yeah, we've calculated that in some ways. I think that tariffs overall cost a typical American family $300 or $400 a year, which hits low-income people particularly hard because they pay a higher percentage. Low-income people pay a higher percentage of their income in tariffs than the wealthy do for reasons we've already touched on. I don't have the figure off the top of my head, but it's several hundred dollars a year per family, and there's simply no reason for it.
You know what, as Phil, you touched on it earlier, that there is a, you know, the argument in favor of tariffs and in favor of Buy America provisions that kind of undergird them is that this will keep jobs in America. It'll keep good paying middle class jobs. Lisa, I'm curious, when you were touring the country and, you know, and the methodology of this book is pretty great because not only is it highly researched, but you did spend a lot of time talking to a lot of people in a lot of different circumstances. Were people aware, were, you know, kind of middle Americans or lower income Americans, were they aware of the, you know, that tariffs come, you know, that they're getting screwed by this? Or do they generally see themselves as beneficiaries of policies that make imports more expensive?
Oh, no. You know, it's interesting because most of the travel I did was during the early part of the Trump administration when he was throwing tariffs, you know, so the tariffs were in the news a lot. So I think people were better informed than they otherwise would have been because there were stories in the news about how washing machines were now costing more and tires were going to cost more. And so he really actually, you know, brought to light that there were, but a lot of these tariffs existed before he came in, although he vastly expanded this whole, right, you know, it's crazy tariff system of ours. But so I think that people have become more aware, you know, especially because when it came to washing machines, that really made people mad. You know, it's like, why do I have to pay $50 more for a washing machine just because we're in this fight with, you know, some other country? And the thing is, the idea of, like, you know, Buy American and all that, well, a lot of these products aren't available in America. We don't make them, we import them, you know. So, and then the argument that, oh, well, that'll fall on those mean, nasty foreigners trying to sell us goods that, you know, they'll have to pay the price for this. Well, they didn't pay the price. They passed the price on to the consumer. And so Americans, I think, you know, Phil's number of $300 to $400 per family was pre-Trump, you know, administration. And by, you know, 2 or 3 years into his administration, the number had gone up to $600 or $700. So, it, you know, it starts to hit the pocketbook.
And there is that epistemological issue, too, of you're touching on of, you know, what is actually made in America, mm-hmm. Because certain products come in partly finished and then, you know, people add a screw or a couple of details to something. And that might count as American made versus mm-hmm. something else. Yeah. Right.
Oh, and then there's all the crazy. I mean, there's a whole subset of engineers whose job it is to get around these tariffs by redesigning a product so that it can skirt whatever the rules are for the tariffs. And probably the funniest one in the book is a guy who, there was a big tariff on feathers being imported because people use feathers, right, for fly fishing. And, but he discovered that there was not much of a tariff on feather dusters. So he just took all the feathers, tied them into feather dusters, shipped them here, and then took them apart and sold the feathers. So, you know, people are spending their brain energy on stuff like that when they could be, you know, doing something more productive with their time.
Let's talk about stadiums, publicly funded sports stadiums, because, and Phil, I think in a way, you know, on a certain level, this is, I don't want to say any of this is trivial, but this seems to be less, you know, demonstrably horrific to everyday life, but it's also a perfect encapsulation of what you're talking about, because virtually every professional sports team is owned by one or more billionaires. And then they bilk local, state, local, and federal governments for grants on things. And you have a chart in recent books or recent stadiums that were constructed between 1997 and 2015. And there are some stadiums, such as the MetLife Stadium, where the New York Giants and Jets play, that got 0% of public funding. Those are the rarities. It's more like there's more closer to instances like where the Raymond James Stadium in Tampa Bay, where the Tampa Bay Buccaneers play, that got 100% of public funding, of $194 million. What is the argument that, what are the arguments that are made in favor of publicly financing stadiums?
I think that this one is in many ways a little different, because the public likes to have sports stadiums nearby. They offer a certain amount of prestige, and you don't see an awful lot of backlash when it's pointed out that the taxpayers of a particular city, it's usually sales tax, sometimes other taxes, but the taxpayers are picking up a very substantial portion of, as you say, the cost of the stadium to team owners, virtually all of whom are centimillionaires or billionaires. So it does illustrate, I think, two things. One is that the propensity to aid the rich, that is, to use public funds, taxpayer funds, to produce things that help rich people. But it also illustrates that the public doesn't get very excited about it because it only costs them a few pennies a week, or that's what it seems. And it's nice to have that stadium around. There are large...
You know, until this year or last year, I don't know if the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, you know, if their fan or the people in the area would have necessarily thought that. The second, on this one chart that you have, the second most highly subsidized stadium in recent memory was the Cincinnati Bengals Paul Brown Stadium in Cincinnati. 94% of a $450 million stadium was charged to the public. I know I was living in the area when that stadium was built. Of course, had massive cost overruns, and the Bengals pay very little to on an ongoing basis. They get all of the money from the parking and concessions and all sorts of things. People were promised that there would be lots of jobs associated with this. Lisa, do stadiums create the kind of economic development that is often also one of the ways that it's sold to the public?
You know, there's been so many, there have been books written just about stadium subsidies and what a bad idea they are. And, you know, and yet the public in whatever city the latest stadium gets proposed in, people just go for it. They just somehow just miss the memo or just don't pay attention to the research. But oftentimes what the stadium, you know, owners will say, or the team owners will say is, oh, well, as soon as you build that stadium, there's going to go, hotels are going to come in and restaurants are going to come in and it's going to be amazing. We're going to rejuvenate the city. And seldom does that ever happen. And my favorite example in the book is not a big stadium. It's not a, you know, NFL league, but this small B team in Hartford, Connecticut that was owned by millionaires. And they want convince the city of Hartford to build them this stadium that ended up costing the city, you know, $67 million, and which is exactly the amount of money that the city is in the hole right now. So I'm not sure why that one got passed, but it did. And it's a lovely stadium. I went there for opening day, and it's quite, you know, charming and all that. But why this citizens of Hartford, Connecticut should be subsidizing the Hartford yard goats is beyond me. You know, it just, you know, if you want to have your sports teams, then all those millionaire owners can certainly build those things themselves. And in Hartford's case, you know, they promised that the stadium would soon have restaurants and hotels and everything all the way around it, but they built it in a very depressed part of the city where nobody wants to build anything. So none of that, you know, development is happening.
You know, another area that you guys write about a lot, it has to do with zoning. And again, this is something that I don't think people normally think about as a kind of transfer program from the poor to the rich, or from the actual middle class to the rich. Phil, can you talk a little bit about the variety of ways in which zoning is used to kind of extract money from, middle and lower income people to pad the wallets of the well-off?
Basically, by making housing so expensive in areas where the best jobs are, that only the wealthy can afford to live there. The zoning laws keep it that way. The zoning laws will not permit the construction of multifamily units, for example, a high rise or a building with apartments, particularly near a public transportation, because they don't want their neighborhoods to be anything but single family units. They dig in their heels. The prices of those homes keep going up and up and up. And the city of San Francisco, for example, or the various cities in the San Francisco area have made it so expensive to live anywhere near jobs that a great many things are happening. One is that some people end up commuting for 2 hours each way to get into jobs because they can't afford to live in the city, so they go way, way out to be able to afford housing. Another symptom of this is that California has by far the highest rate of homelessness of any state in the country, because expensive housing means that it's very expensive for California, even when they want to be nice to the homeless, to find them and provide accommodation that may do something to help solve that problem. So when you forbid the construction of additional housing, what you are doing is saying that all the housing that exists now is going to get more and more and more expensive. Mm-hmm. And working people are not going to find any place in that environment to live.
What do you think the effects of the pandemic might be on this particular situation? We'll talk more about your kind of reform plans towards the end of our conversation. But particularly with housing prices, it seems, you know, we've been hearing for the past year because of COVID that people are leaving cities like San Francisco, like New York City, Boston, L.A. Do you think that will, and that rents there in many places are actually declining, do you think that will lead to a reevaluation of housing policy at all? Or is it really just this is a blip in an onward trajectory of making housing more expensive precisely where people want to live?
Well, I think the pandemic, I mean, the one thing that we've seen is that lo and behold, we can work at home. And I think that there, you know, a lot mm-hmm. of office buildings are not going to be filled again. You know, a lot of people have learned that they can effectively do their jobs without leaving their homes. And so then the need to live in San Francisco or New York or Seattle is less pressing. I mean, unless you happen to like living in a big city. But so I think that there are people sort of reevaluating why they moved to those places. So I think we are going to see some movement. Because I don't think a lot of jobs, I don't think we'll ever go back to office buildings full of people who, especially in the industry where you don't have to be in the office necessarily. I mean, what I'd love to see is some of those office buildings transformed into housing. I mean, that would be fantastic. But that would require a lot of will on the parts of the developers and the owners and all that. But I mean, if we're going to have empty office buildings in downtown Manhattan, why not turn them into some housing, which we desperately need, you know? So.
Right. And who is responsible? Oh, go ahead, Phil.
And there's usually a regulation that forbids it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's, I was going to, this bleeds into the, you know, an adjacent topic that you cover at length in the book, which is regulation. And I mean, zoning is obviously a form of regulation, but, you know, the way property is zoned for different types of uses, like there needs to be a legal change. Is that likely to happen? Or, and I guess another way of saying that, is it, is the status quo actively enforced by today's developers and the people who own the property? I mean, how do you get to a point where you might be able to redevelop an office building in downtown Manhattan or midtown Manhattan into something more residential or mixed use?
Well, I think if the owners of those buildings start losing rent, they're going to suddenly become very interested in what other uses they can put their buildings to. So, I mean, I guess there will need to be a financial incentive. And if that comes, that would be a, you know, that would be a window of opportunity for them to say, oh, well, we used to be opposed to changing these buildings into housing, but now we're not. So that'll be really interesting. I think watch San Francisco and New York. I think those will be the big ones that are going to get, you know, and they're the ones with the worst housing problems in the country by far. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
And the pressures on the other side are going to build up too. I mean, there's a point beyond which a state or a city simply cannot prohibit additional construction of housing units because the need becomes so desperate. And I think that parts of California have reached that point now. They're beginning to find certain ways around it. They're permitting, what do they call them, grandmother-in-law housing, that you can put up a unit in your backyard if your yard is big enough.
Right.
They had to fight like hell to get permission to do that. But basically, your mother and dad can move into something on your property.
So the good news is that you can add a dwelling to your property. The bad news is that your mother-in-law.
That's about it. It doesn't. it doesn't have to be your mother-in-law. It could be your mother.
Well, it might help. It'll help with the divorce rate, then, right? You know, at least in the short term. You talk about environmental regulations as well. Here's a question from a libertarian point of view. I tend to believe that a lot of environmental regulations are, they're not really subject to strict cost benefit analyses, and they tend to be more aspirational, or people do them out of almost as a form of virtue signaling. But there's also a serious argument that poor people in general bear the brunt of environmental, of pollution and despoilation of everyday air and water and things like that. What are the costs of environmental regulations, and how do they function as a way of hurting poor people and again, lining the pockets of well-off people?
Well, the extent that we address this issue in the book has to do really with the subsidization of corporations primarily. That is, even a good libertarian understands the instinct of government actors to encourage the development of solar power and wind power,
right.
Even though when the government does it, it usually fails. But that's another subject. On the other hand, subsidizing the production of coal, which we still do, subsidizing the production of oil and gas, which we still do, is environmentally and economically and every other way I can think of nuts. They're simply.
By the way, you know, this is a libertarian podcast, so you can curse if you feel moved to at all moments. Well, let's talk about energy subsidies, because one of the things, and I think, you know, for me, reading this section, which is in many ways is the kind of weightiest section of the book, in my estimation, is about kind of the welfare for the rich as it relates to energy production. And you've kind of outlined the range of things. On the one hand, we are massively subsidizing the dirtiest of dirty, you know, of energy in terms of like keeping coal alive. And that was certainly a big part of Donald Trump's rhetoric and some of his actions. But on the other hand, we're also subsidizing a ton of renewable energy. Let's talk first about the dirty stuff. What are we doing for coal and oil And how does that, how does that work to make energy cost more for poor people and, make rich people even richer?
You want to tell the Louisiana story, Lisa? That I think is very illustrative of what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, so in Louisiana, and this is actually a success story at the end, but so for many years, since the 1930s, all of those oil companies along the Gulf Coast, Dow and Exxon Mobil and all the chemical companies down there have benefited from not having to pay local property taxes. And this was sort of a very, very well-kept secret for decades. And there was a little committee of five people in the legislature that was tasked with, reviewing their requests for tax abatements and their request to not pay any property taxes in Louisiana. So there are these giant, fields of industry going on down there. And they weren't putting a dime into the public coffers in the way of property taxes. And along came some, citizen activists who were looking at the USA Today ranking of the states that comes out every year. And Louisiana kept landing at the bottom of that list every year in terms of, health and education and all these things. And these folks were looking at it and saying, well, that's weird because we have, so much oil here and we have so much, all these really wealthy companies. Why don't we have any money to address any of this? And they stumbled upon this little committee that was rubber stamping requests from these oil companies. And so they started a public education campaign just saying, hey, how much better would our schools be? How much better would our police forces be? How much better would our fire departments, be able to handle emergencies? How much better would our roads be if those guys would just pay their fair share? And they managed to get the law changed so that now when those companies go and ask for those tax breaks, they have to make presentations to local school boards and fire departments and police departments and saying, hey, we don't want to pay taxes and support you because we don't think we should. So it's very early.
They can't really threaten and say, if you don't meet our request, we're going to go and drill for oil in Nebraska or something.
Well, and that's the interesting thing is that they're stuck there. I mean, the reason they're there is because that's where, what they need is. So there's absolutely no justification for this, but it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out, going forward. But it was a great, example of how when you do find something like this is just so egregiously stupid that it is possible to fight back even against people like Dow and Exxon Mobil and all that and get some redress. And to me, that's what I just kept running across, no matter what issue I was talking about with people, was that it was just, it's just, we have to pay. I pay my taxes every year. You pay your taxes every year. Phil pay, mm-hmm. We all just do our part.
Phil pays much more in taxes than either of us. But
that's probably true.
And you should be paying even more than is what you're getting at.
Yeah, but if that's true, then I wouldn't be able to provide any assistance to reason.
Well, you know what? I'm willing to live in the light of that.
All right.
Burning truth. Well, in the energy section that you're talking about, you write, ExxonMobil received close to $4 billion in subsidies between 2010 and 2017, according to Good Jobs First, which is a great resource for all of this kind of stuff. And ExxonMobil spent $193 million on lobbying between when they were getting $4 billion in subsidies. Right. So it comes back to this incredible return on investment for lobbying, right? Because you only have to get a few legislators at various levels to really open the spigots. Let's let's talk about Elon Musk. He comes up in the subsidy section of renewables. Elon Musk, in many ways, he's one of the most fascinating. He's one of the wealthiest people on the planet. One of the most fascinating. He has a vision for the future. He wants to go to Mars. He created Tesla, which has really kind of revolutionized the electric car, renewed interest and the viability of an electric car market. He also has his hands in a kind of bad solar panel industry. Phil, how does Elon Musk kind of instantiate or personify some of the or many of the concerns you're talking about here, particularly as it relates to renewable energy?
Well, he seems to have a magic touch. One author who has studied Musk's various enterprises, says he's gotten so good at raising money from state governments, getting subsidies, tax abatements, and so on, that sometimes it seems as though the states are lining up to offer him money to come and do business in their states. He's just brilliant at it. And the more successful he is at getting these subsidies and payments, the more states line up to offer him money. And I can't, as a libertarian, I can't say that that's bad, except that the state governments ought to know better. He does, of course, get subsidies for things that are considered in the public good, including Tesla. But I don't think you can explain the extent of his success in any other way except to say that he's awfully, awfully good at it.
Well, he's a perfect example. I mean, he ends up in our book. Bill Gates ends up in our book. All of these billionaires end up in the book. And, you know, there's no denying that they've done amazing things with their businesses. But my frustration with all of them is they have plenty of money. Why are they asking taxpayers to pay their way? I don't get it. I mean, when Bill Gates went to Congress and said he needed $1 billion for his nuclear energy company, and he said, I'll put in $1 billion, my friend will put in $1 billion, and then you got, you know, taxpayers put in $1 billion. Well, why? Go find another one of your billionaire friends to throw in another billion. Mm-hmm. Why do you need us to be, you know, financing this stuff? So I don't argue with their success, but, you know, when they say they did it all themselves, or they say that, you know, look how amazing we are, you know, taxpayers should know that they help subsidize all that.
Let's talk about taxes. You have a lengthy section on taxes and tax breaks. And, you know, Phil, what's the most, you know, what stands out to you the most as an example of a tax policy that really, that just benefits the rich at the expense of the public till?
Well, probably carried interest is the most egregious example of carving out a nice loophole for a particular category of workers. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that? Your book, by the way, I want to commend you, is the first time that I understand now what the carried interest loophole is. But could you explain that and talk about why it's actually unnecessary?
It allows particular financial workers, people who are in the financial industry, businesses of various kinds, to convert the income from their investments to capital gains. Capital gains are taxed at a much lower rate than income is taxed. And in this particular case, commentators are more or less unanimous, saying there's really no difference here between the income from a book or income from investments of the kind that these folks make. I bring it up only because most other tax breaks, except the kind that we've already talked about, tend to have some defenders. There are a lot of people who don't think capital gains should be taxed at a lower rate at all. And you can make a pretty good case for that.
I was kind of surprised by that, though, because I always thought that part of the argument for taxing capital gains at a lower rate was that, among other things, they'd already been taxed. So instead of taxing the same dollar multiple times at higher levels, you know, why would you tax people saving money or investing money?
Well, that's the argument, but capital gains have not necessarily been taxed. They may have been taxed by a state, but not necessarily. The rationale is simply that if the value of an investment, this would be the same on your own home, for example, which is why capital gains rates remain pretty popular. When you sell the property, whether it's your house or a share of General Electric, the gain from the time that you paid it and bought it till the time you sell it is taxed at a lower rate to encourage investment in the kinds of things that that are considered to be economically sound for the economy. I'm not personally opposed to a somewhat lower rate for capital gains, but a lot of perfectly sensible people are. Why should income from investments be taxed at a lower rate than sweat income from working hard? And philosophically, that's a difficult question to answer.
Of course, if tax rates were lower generally, perhaps you would be more comfortable reducing the income tax rate to whatever capital gains is.
Or both to less than capital gains is. I mean, our position finally on taxes is that what we would benefit most from in this country would be a flat rate at a relatively low level with very, very few exceptions.
I mean, one of the things that's fascinating is that in the discussion of taxes, a lot of things come up on how to maximize either how to change people's behavior so they do us, you know, they eat less of a certain thing or they invest more in the things we think they should invest in, including a house. And your, I think, destruction of the, you know, the goodness of the mortgage interest deduction is really great to read. But, you know, part of the tax code is to gull us into acting a certain way. And then another part which seems to go missing is, you know, that it's supposed to cover the costs of government. You know, and it is frustrating to me. I mean, for my entire life, I think as a journalist at Reason, people never talk about, charging the amount of taxes necessary to cover the amount of spending that we're doing. They're always looking for a way to get out of actually covering the full bill, which I think allows us to spend a lot more money than we would have to if we actually had to pay for the amount of government we're buying in a given year.
Well, I mean, that's self-evident. There's no, we've been running deficits ever since Clinton's presidency, and they're getting bigger every year. And there are a few people, believe it or not, who think a $21 trillion debt is not healthy.
No, it's just the down payment on the future, right? We're now in an era where, you know, the elite consensus is it's a good time to borrow more money because interest rates are so low. Let's talk about kind of solutions to all of this, because it's a comprehensive book that covers virtually every aspect of the ways in which various policies are set up to, as you know, I mean, it's in the title of the book, to provide welfare for the rich. And it's the most egregious when it's billionaires bilking, thousandaires for, you know, loose change. And they're able to pull that off because they get the concentrated benefits. They have the political power. They have the ear of Congress and of state legislators and of governors and of whoever, you know, local dog catchers. Lisa, can you talk a little bit about what are the ways that we actually address, how to readjust the system?
Well, I think that one of the ways is getting involved at whatever level. And that's what I love about that Louisiana story, is that there was nothing special about this people that, you know, found that tax that was so egregious, or tax abatement that was so egregious. They were just everyday Americans that were trying to make their lives better, who found a problem and solved it. And that happens around the country. I mean, there are more success stories in the book. And I think that just civic activism is just, it's something that we could all do more of and that we should all take the time to do. And that may sound really simplistic, but it is, that's what's going to make change, is, you know, finding out these stories and then saying, you know what, I don't want to pay for that anymore. I think that guy needs to pay his own way and make enough of a stink that something happens. And I believe that, you know, we mentioned a lot of really great databases. You mentioned Good Jobs First is one of them, but there's also openthebooks.gov and a couple others that are putting all this kind of spending online in real time. So you can go on and look and see, you know, what's being spent at the federal level and state level, and go through it and say, wait a minute, why is there, you know, what's going on? And I think those databases are great. And then, of course, the other piece of that is having all that data available, then having journalists like you and writers and people pointing out the stories and writing about them like we did for this book, just saying, you know, making the public aware of it, because it's one thing to have a database up there, but if nobody's looking at it or understanding what it's about. So to me, those are probably the most important things, is get involved at your local or state, you know, if you're comfortable at the local level, if or do the federal level, you know, but find a way to just start blowing the whistle on this stuff, because it does work. You know, I mean, it can make a difference. And then, you know, really support the work of people who are making all this stuff really available. I mean, a decade ago, we didn't have these kinds of numbers. We didn't have this information. And now we do. So thanks to the internet for that. And then, you know, take the time like you are today to, you know, to talk about this issue and point people in that direction.
Would you, Phil, do you think, what is the benefit of pairing this, holding people accountable, holding government accountable for treating all citizens similarly, you know, on the tax side and on the regulation side? Do we also need to be putting forth a vision of a government that does fewer things more efficiently? How much is that a part of addressing, you know, this problem?
Well, who's going to put forward a vision? I think every human being has to have their own vision, their own mission in life, their own beliefs. I don't think we really can have or should have a national vision, except for those relatively few things, but they're important, that we all share. The emphasis on individual liberty and freedom does not subsume or prevent believing in a national identity, as long as that identity isn't coercive, which it tends to be, as you know. But I don't think that any particular party, and certainly not the federal government, is particularly able or likely to provide a vision that exceeds what every individual can do for him or herself.
All right. We're going to leave it there. I want to thank Phil Harvey and Lisa Conyers, the authors of Welfare for the Rich, for talking to Reason. Thanks, guys, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.